Ladies and gentlemen, this is the third of the three talks that I'm giving at the Speaker's Corner. On Tuesday, we had the future of me. Yesterday, the future of us. And today, in conclusion, the future of all. So now, at last, we've come to the end, Speaker's Corner, of my three talks of everything, to the future of all. At least, as far as scientists envision it, it's an approaching gradual senescence, slow senility. Everything expands and cools like nitrous from a whippet until all has finally ceased in its movement. Now that, being perhaps a trillion years away from now, it is more appropriate to talk of other futures, which are just as all-consuming, but rather more immediate. There's a word on nearly everyone's lips. It's most often left unvoiced. You know that word. Some of you will never let me forget it. Eschaton. The impending end of everything. It's become a fixed star in this particular corner of culture that on 21 December 2012, the world comes to an end. Now, knowing your expiration date, that's a big thing, a huge thing. It can be very empowering, possibly. But this received knowledge, we must next ask, did you receive it? Was it revealed to you personally? Did someone tell you? Or did it come in a short? Did it come in short, via human communication? Because we cannot trust communication. We must always distrust communication. Every word we hear is both truth and lie. Yet, so many are ready to believe, ready to take that leap of faith, ready to declare that this sick, corrupt, shallow, unconscious mess that we generously call a civilization, ready to declare that a failed experiment. And because we are ready to believe, we receive the word of the eschaton, uncritically, unthinkingly, unconsciously. And this idea drives a huge segment of our community. It has become an idée fixée, an organizing principle. Now, as you know, I have nothing against expiration dates. They can be quite important, and they drive us to dedication and to self-work. But I need to ask, do you see this happening? Does the knowledge that there's just a little bit more 6 years left on our civilizational clock drive any individual that you have ever met ever to change their lives? Have we seen anyone abandon their attachments and prepare themselves for this presumed inevitable end? You know the answer. I know the answer. The answer is no. Now, if we really believed this, things would be different. Because here we have some precedent. In the 1830s, a preacher named Miller. First name of Miller. Millerites, Miller.
Oh.
Okay. A preacher named Miller announced that he had, through meticulous study of the scriptures and amazing arithmetic, calculated the date of the second coming, 1843. October, right? 1843. And his followers, the Millerites, joined together in a sort of apostolic communism. They shared their goods They sold them off as the day approached, and the great day approached and approached and passed. Ah! Miller announced, I'm sorry, there's a small error in the arithmetic. Just missed something. 1844 and this time for sure. And so the Millerites rejoiced, and they waited, and they prayed, and the blessed day approached and approached and passed. And in American history, this day is known as the Great Disappointment. It is in all your textbooks. The Millerites had sold or given away everything in preparation, and now poor and disappointed, they went forth. Some of them became what we know today as the Seventh-day Adventists, and others formed smaller Protestant sects. And so on forward, to the Jehovah's Witnesses in, what was it, 1914, Jonestown in the 1970s, Heaven's Gate in the 1990s, a recurring theme, an absence of the end and a forcing of the hand of God. But actually, we have a lot less to worry about here, because if I saw anyone anywhere actually acting as though 2012 were some sort of inevitability, I might be growing concerned. Instead, we carry on, blindly, blandly, as though time stretched on indefinitely without limit. In one sense, that's really reassuring, and in another, it's really kind of depressing. Now, I am not John the Baptist declaring the coming of the end, whatever you may think of me. Nor, I should make clear, was Terence McKenna. All right? He put his received wisdom out there, but he did not say, take this and eat. What he said was, take this and test it. His greatest disappointment in life, I reckon, was that so few really ever took that challenge up. Instead, his fans took his story, hook, line, and sinker, set their clocks, and waited, but did nothing. And that is this era's great disappointment. Now, what would we do if we really believed in our hearts that the eschaton was close at hand? That knowing would transform us. It would transform our actions to perfection. It would transform our visions to clarity. It would transform our hearts to perfect love, perfect trust, and perfect understanding. And I do not see this. And yet we hope. And if only because of my own association with McKenna, an association that Eric also shares. People often look to me for some sort of confirmation, even when that's not on the menu. Last year, I gave a lecture at the Mindstates Conference. It was an hour discussion of my recent work about social networks and media and how we are changing and transforming the way we communicate across all boundaries. It was a major new idea of mine called Hyperpeople, and it talked about a whole range of different things. And I never mentioned the eschaton once, but it was a good talk. I think people thought it was a good talk. It was exciting. And we open up the audience to questions, and the first question that comes in is about the time wave and the I Ching. And I did my best, and I sort of gave them an answer on the spot, because the only thing that they wanted to hear, the only thing they wanted to hear from me, is some confirmation of a belief that they're holding only because they heard it and because they want it to be true. I have grown weary of this. I have had enough of this. And fortunately, I'll have no more of this, because I can simply demur and refer all comers to Daniel Pinchbeck, who has titled his latest book, 2012. He wants to own this space. He can have it. He can have it. He can have it.
Where's the glove?
I've often equated the idea of the eschaton with a technological singularity. And that's a term that was coined by science fiction writer Werner Vinci. Werner's a friend of mine. And we had long conversations about the singularity, and somewhere in the midst of one of the first ones, he just sort of perked up and said with a bit of a bark in disgust, "You're a gradualist!" And this may be true, for while I definitely do hold to a type of technological determinism that we will ascend into something that is at this moment ineffable and unknowable and utterly different, I don't hold to the fact that this happens in the twinkling of an eye. It might look that way in retrospect, but it will be from that retrospect that we will recognize singularity. Now, I do not believe in artificial intelligence, nor that any superhuman intelligence will suddenly arise and overwhelm us all. It simply does not work that way. We have no precedence in any historic or scientific record for that sort of transformation. Instead, nature works by subsumption. Something emerges and it subsumes that which comes before. The mitochondria in every one of your cells is proof of that. There is no alien other, at least none on this earth. For all intelligence, vegetable, animal, or mineral, all intelligence is one. All intelligence is just intelligence. Now, perhaps the most visible proponent, and if you read the signs coming in, for a technological singularity, is author and inventor Ray Kurzweil. And for years, through his books, he has promoted another kind of eschaton, where the machine intelligences multiply their capabilities so rapidly that they transcend human understanding. And this seems to me to be entirely impossible, could only be possible if these machines were born in an entirely separate universe, untainted by human contact. This is not that world. For we can no more draw a line between ourselves and our machines than I can draw a line between myself and my eyeglasses. They are prosthetics, these machines. And perhaps we are theirs, but neither is complete without the other. The rise of artificial intelligence is a misapprehension. The rise of intelligence, however, seems historically inevitable. And so it was with a great deal of skepticism that I sat through a lecture by Ray Kurzweil at a conference in Pisa where we were both speaking. And I was speaking about something that I call the rise of hyperintelligence and spoke of Wikipedia as the first identifiable artifact of the age of hyperintelligence. It's a collected and connected knowledge of nearly a billion human minds. It's not an artificial intelligence, it's just intelligence. And it's a whole lot more of it than we've ever had before. Then Kurzweil spoke, and I braced myself for a descent into bullshit, for an exploration of ideas that lacked a fundamental grounding in the reality of the world. And, to my shock and my surprise, I found Kurzweil had repented. You see, in his future, as he talks about it now, we design these intelligences using the only guide we have at hand, the human brain. Because we can now design and simulate some of the simpler neural structures in our heads. For example, the cerebellum, which controls locomotion and coordination, contains only four types of nerve cells. That's it. That's all your genes have to make. Just lots and lots of copies of four different kinds of nerve cells. But what happens is that they interconnect based on the stimuli that are received via the nervous system. It starts as a blank slate, and then it emerges into order. In other words, intelligence cannot be made. Intelligence can only be grown. And that means the machines are no different than ourselves. We spend our lives, and very much in particular, our earliest years, emerging into intelligence. And this is known formally as constructivism. And the father of constructivism was the Swiss child psychologist Jean Piaget. And what he determined was that children learn about the world by playing within it. They are perfect scientists. They start with hypotheses, they put these hypotheses to the test, and if they work, they get it subsumed into the next layer of understanding, and if they break, they're modified and they're put to the test again, and they do this over and over and over, and if they're smart, they never stop. All children do this all the time, and so will our machines. So, they are not our masters, these beings of metal. They are our children. And how could we not but love our children? And how could they not but love us? So yes, we may be the weird, cranky, opinionated elderly relatives of these new beings, but at least we will be beloved by them and probably honored for our wisdom, because we'll have been around longer, we'll know more about what went on. At least, that's the theory. And the next generations will put this theory to the test. But unlike the prognostications of a sudden, shuddering catastrophic drop over the cataracts of history, this theory has observation to support it. It seems to be the way the world works. And that, I believe, is what lies ahead for the future of us all.